This is Radio Boston. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And we're going to begin our program today with the latest in our series of conversations looking back at some of the big stories of 2011. And Adam, what a year it was in Boston Federal Court.
That's right. From mob bust to corruption and terrorism, case after important case kept WBUR senior reporter David Boeri coming back to the Moakley Courthouse in South Boston.
This has been a remarkable year, almost comparable to the weather in my town in central Massachusetts. An earthquake, a tornado, a hurricane, a flood, and a nor'easter coming into November?
Well, let's begin back in January when Diane Wilkerson, once the rising star of the Massachusetts Democratic Party, was sentenced to 3.5 years in jail for taking $23,000 in bribes from a federal informant. A couple of weeks later, Boston City Councilor Chuck Turner is sentenced to 3 years for taking a mere $1,000 bribe from the same informant. And then in the summer, we had the corruption trial of former State House Speaker Sal DeMacy. In September, he's sentenced to 8 years for taking kickbacks. And then just a couple of weeks ago, 1,000 miles away in Chicago, Rob Blagojevich gets 14 years for trying to sell Barack Obama's old Illinois Senate seat. So, David, was this the year that the federal judiciary really decided to drop the hammer on public corruption?
It would appear so, but it also appears to be a year in which we've established that perhaps politicians accused of corruption are only slightly less unpopular than Al-Qaeda. Seriously, in Massachusetts, federal prosecutors, and especially Republican U.S. attorneys, have always been impatient and they've been scornful of the state's unwillingness to go after political corruption in a statehouse controlled traditionally here by Democrats. And it's noticeable, by the way, that these three cases in Massachusetts, Wilkerson, Turner, and then Sal DeMacy, were all started under Republican U.S. attorneys. For DeMacy, who was the starring character this year, his misfortune was that he was coming at the end of the string. His two predecessors, both speakers of the House before him, had been charged with felonies, pled out, and they didn't do any time. Mm-hmm. And then Judge Wolf, who sentenced DeMacy, made a point of the fact that the sentencing had been far too lenient for white-collar criminals and especially for the corruption of public officials who should be warranting the trust of the public.
Well, there's a bigger legal narrative at play in these cases having to do with so-called honest services fraud, the idea that it's a crime to deprive the public of your ethical conduct. It was challenged this year in the Supreme Court in a case involving the former Enron executive Jeff Skilling. And the Supreme Court upheld the law, and DeMacy was the first person in the country following that decision to be convicted of honest services fraud.
That's right. And this case may well be headed back to the Supreme Court. And it illustrates something. I mean, this whole idea to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services, this vague crime as stated, it obviously made the U.S. Supreme Court unhappy because they restricted it in Skilling to only cover, and I'm reading, fraudulent schemes to deprive another of honest services through bribes or kickbacks supplied by a third party who has not been deceived. Now, what does that mean? It's still incredibly vague, and this is what DeMacy's attorneys pointed out at the trial, although it is important to note, as Judge Wolf did at the time of sentencing, that what Sal DeMacy did was good old-fashioned political corruption, that the center of the case against him was the fact that he had a law associate taking money and then passing it on to him for work on the company that wanted the project that he eventually got in classic quid pro quo fashion.
David, this was also the year of some notable mob busts. First and foremost, in June, Whitey Bulger is found after 16 years on the lam, 16 years in which the FBI and you, among other people, had been scouring the earth for him. They find him living a retiree's life in Santa Monica. How did you feel when you first heard that they'd caught Whitey?
Well, I certainly did not believe it at first. And then my second thought was to think of all the opportunities that had been blown, frankly, over the years, and the particular misfortune that the FBI had settled on this so-called sighting in London in 2002. They had bought it hook, line, and sinker. At the time, I was talking to people saying it is clearly not true, but they seem to have locked on to that so that the whole search for Whitey was international, and they never turned to the West Coast, which, by the way, I had been to in 2000, exploring the possibility that he was in Southern California, crossing the border to get medications in Mexico. It turned out 11 years later, that's where he was. On the one hand, you say the FBI finally got their man, and you have to credit that. They also got their man after they brought in the U.S. Marshals, whose involvement they had fought for so many years. Then, for the FBI, another embarrassment, because suddenly we have the discovery of another top echelon informant, a guy named Mark Rossetti, who I knew, and I knew to be an informant in the early 1990s.
He was a top capo in the New England mob, right?
Right. Rossetti is tied into murders. He's tied into a whole wing of the mafia and all sorts of operations, and he did it while he was talking to an FBI agent. So suddenly you have the FBI caught in the very behavior that brought about spectacularly and catastrophically the Bulger mob. They were doing business with the head of an organization, which you never are supposed to do, which the manual says you never do, and yet they did. And having been burned badly once, we found out they were dealing with Rossetti again. They've been dealing with him for a long time as a top echelon informant.
Any chance he might go on the lam, or is he in federal custody?
No, he's locked in. I think he's locked in and locked down. And if, in fact, he sees that he has no other way of escape, he could then start talking about the FBI people he was talking to.
Let's move on to terrorism. In September, a 26-year-old Massachusetts-born guy of Bangladeshi descent named Rezwan Firdaus, a Northeastern grad, is picked up by the FBI for allegedly plotting to fly explosives on remote control planes into the Pentagon and the Capitol. And it's not clear if he had the wherewithal to actually pull this off or if he was just a wannabe. And then just a couple of weeks ago, Tariq Mahana, another 20-something guy from the western suburbs, is convicted on federal terrorism charges, not for a bomb plot, but for translating terrorist boilerplate and putting it on the internet. What do these two cases mean to you as a group, Davin?
Once again, in terms of Mahana, just like with honest services fraud, you have a vague criminal federal statute involving material support to terrorist organizations, to organizations, I should say, that are designated as terrorist organizations. And this, too, has come out of the Supreme Court recently with a ruling that restricted the meaning of that. The Supreme Court said that it means either working for or in coordination with terrorist organizations. This is the first case coming out of that. This, too, may be heading back. What does it mean to be working in coordination with a foreign terrorist organization? Obviously, we're not talking about cash. He wasn't giving them ammunition. He was giving them translation services. The government pushed the envelope further than they've done ever before on these terrorist cases to go after somebody who, in fact, they claimed was working as the English language wing of Al-Qaeda by doing the translations and doing subtitles for videos as well. The jury in this case came back in such stunningly short time.
10 hours.
10 hours, despite the fact that this was an 8-week trial with some 31 days of testimony. It's going to send a signal to them, the government, to do more of this, again, with this vague law. And by the way, it's interesting. At this time last year, the former U.S. Attorney General Michael Mukasey, Rudy Giuliani, the mayor of New York, and Tom Ridge, the former Homeland Security Secretary, all spoke in support of an Iranian opposition group. That group happens to be designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the United States. So far, I haven't seen Mukasey, Giuliani, or Ridge indicted.
But providing material support.
For providing material support, as it would be constituted under that criminal statute, it would seem. So you come now to Rezwan Firdaus, and it's a new strategy, which is a preventive strategy to pick up wannabes or terrorists before they actually commit acts. With Firdaus, it is most spectacular because this guy is a 7-iron shot away from being a street crazy. He is clearly a mentally disturbed individual. At one point, there was a report to the Hopkinton police that he was standing in the middle of the road, disoriented and apparently urinating on himself. He has not had a job since he graduated in 2008 from Northeastern University. He did not have enough money to pay a $100 parking ticket, and yet he has a warehouse. He buys a drone to build and pack with explosives.
This is all according to the federal indictment.
Yes. And what we know is employees of the FBI gave him the money to rent the warehouse. They paid for him to go down to Washington to proceed with his plot to blow up the Pentagon and the Capitol building. They paid for the ammunition itself. They paid for the drone, the prosecutors say. He had a plan, and it was to attack people as they came out of those buildings that he had bombed. He said he needed six people. At the time they arrested him, there were four people: Rezwan, two undercover FBI agents, and the cooperating witness, a junkie who was taking dope at the time he was working for the government. It's no joke to suggest that if this indictment were to be true, they would have named the FBI agents as unindicted co-conspirators. But it indicates that the government is steadfast in its plan to go after people that it sees as dangers before they become dangers. And the question, of course, in the end is how much of a danger was Mahana? How much of a danger was Firdaus?
Looking back at 2011, David, are we living in punitive times?
We have federal prosecutors that are very aggressive. We have laws that are becoming more vague. And in the vagaries of the law, we're seeing much more prosecution. By the way, the statistics are pretty shocking. 97% of cases that go into federal court end up as plea deals. And of the remaining 3%, something like 87% of them end up in convictions.
Wow.
Yeah, those are the odds.
WBUR senior reporter David Boeri, it's been a terrific year of criminal justice reporting from you. Here's to another year of it in 2012.
Thank you very much.
And coming up after the break, Adam.
Well, we wanted to mention, first of all, that for more top local stories of 2011, head to WBUR.org and check out our interactive timeline right at the top of the page. And Anthony, what do we got next?
Coming up next, why one local theater company is joining others around the nation and allowing audience members to tweet during the show.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.